And we'll do that. All right. The chair calls the Education Finance Committee to order for Tuesday, February 25th, 2025. And we do have a quorum present. Representative Green, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Chair.
And Representative Green, would you like to move approval of the minutes?
Please move the approval of the minutes.
Representative Green moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. And the minutes are approved. Members, we have three bills on the register. The last one, and we're going to move these in order a little bit. The last bill is House File 1034. I'm going to go ahead and move that one up and just get that out of the way. It should be a pretty simple bill, but of course, it is my bill, so you guys can do whatever you want. And I can just talk you down. But we're going to get that one and wait for a couple other members to get in. So Representative Kreisha will move House File 1034, and the intention is to send that to the General Register. I'll give you a minute to grab that. So, members, what this does, and I'll just do it from the chair, and then we'll switch chairs on the next bill, 779, or after House File 1, excuse me. But this bill was working with Chair Joachim, and the last time we put a pilot program together for Little Falls, an aviation, transportation, and CDL program. In that, the school district had to order the equipment to get ready for the fall, and in doing that, they got a bit ahead of the grant process and what was set in place by MDE. So they had some expenses that were incurred, and namely the two simulators, which were about $225,000, which is a large part of the grant. So working with MDE, this legislation allows the school district just to go back and make sure that those expenses are reimbursed and so that they're not left on the hook for those. And that's what this does. So my intent is just to clean that up. We're working with MDE, and we'd like to send it to the General Register, and I'm trying to get the Senate on board as well. So a very simple thing. I know you hear that all the time, but that's really all the bill does. So any questions to the bill? Okay. Representative Lawrence, you going to try to kill the chair's bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, question. So all the dollars have already been appropriated for it. They're just sitting there. They just need to be allowed
Correct.
To go over.
Okay. Yep. The grant was approved 2 years ago, and the dollars are there. It's just a process thing and timing of the payments. So thank you for the question. Other further questions? If not, you guys ready? Chair Joachim, comments?
Thank you, Chair Kreisha, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think that maybe it wasn't clear about when the funding had to be expended, so I'm glad we can fix it. Probably those grant oversight measures we're trying to put into place as we're working on it, but happy to support it.
Thank
you. You guys are doing good work now.
Thank you. And by the way, the program is doing really well, and if I get a chance, I'll give you guys updates on that. But it does highlight an issue that I think we as members have to address, and that is clarifying how this process is with MDE so we can get this right. Sometimes these programs go out, the schools have expectations, and frankly, the school district wasn't exactly clear, and they could have read a couple things better. But schools are busy, and so I think behooves us to try to help that process along, and I think that's what this really is cleaning that up and looking at things going forward. So all those in favor of 1030, I'll renew my motion that House File 1034 is placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? House File 1034 is on its way to the General Register. Okay, Representative Anderson, House File 1. And thank you, committee members, for that. All right, members, we're now going to proceed to the second bill, first bill on your agenda, House File 1. Welcome to the committee, Representative Anderson. You're not a member of the committee. So the chair will move that House File 1 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Representative Anderson, the bill is in front of us. Please proceed with your presentation and your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Kreisha. And I will be relatively brief. I want to give a little background. I know several of you have heard this in other committees already, or you'll hear it in future committees as we keep going around to committees. House File 1 is the bill that essentially creates an independent Office of Inspector General for the state of Minnesota, for essentially state government. A little history. We currently have inspector generals within several agencies across state government, including the Department of Ed, and I'll spend a little time on that. For those of you that maybe weren't on the committee or weren't here 2 years ago. In 2023, because of all the fraud and the issues feeding our future and more and more things that we were seeing, we passed with bipartisan support, which Office of Inspector General within MDE. There is a, I don't recall the number of employees, and it wasn't many. It was less than five, I think, employees. That was passed in 23. I know in 24 there was discussion. I can't remember if it was in front of this committee or in front of the tax committee, where I had asked the gentleman who was the inspector general whether he had essentially the ability to do his job, whether he had enough authority, and he sort of punted and essentially said, not really. and that person is no longer there, by the way. So I don't know if there's a new inspector general already or if there's just an interim in the Department of Ed. So that's just a little history on the Department of Ed. Again, it's a relatively new thing within MDE, but it's not a new thing within some of the other agencies, especially HHS and so on. This bill will be the companion bill to the one that Senator Gustafson is running in the Senate. She and I have been working on this together. We sort of joined forces over the last several weeks, and we've been meeting along with staff, bipartisan or nonpartisan staff from both the House and Senate, legislators from both parties, including Representative Claiborne and others from the House. And I want to thank Lead Joachim for offering to help me in any way that I can, that she's can see over the corner, as it relates to the MDE OIG. So anyone else that's interested in helping, please do. This is not a partisan issue. This is a good government issue. And it's something that we clearly know that we have to get done. Minnesota has seen probably the worst fraud of any state in the nation. And that's not my opinion. That's opinion of essentially Biden-appointed, staff in the past. And it's ongoing. And we've got to make it stop. We've got to get it to stop. So I ask that you support House File 1. I can, again, state there are some issues if you want to discuss any questions on it. I can answer them. And we are meeting tonight again as a committee at 5 o'clock, the folks that are working on it in the House and Senate. We hope to be able to fix some of the data practices, or just minor little things, and to bring our bills together, to merge them together, or to get them as close as we can as we're going through this process. So I'll leave it up to questions.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. We do have one testifier. Will Devin Bruce come up? And while the testifier is coming up, Mr. Strom, if you could just quickly give a summary for the committee. I'll come over to, not Mr. Strom. I'll introduce Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan, welcome to the committee. What I'm looking for is just a quick synopsis of why this impacts the Education Finance Committee and the fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair and members, the House File 1 would create a new independent Office of the Inspector General that would provide oversight of all state agencies, including the Department of Education. So a portion of House File 1, Article 2, would eliminate statute governing MDE's OIG office and the data practices statute that goes along with that, and transfer those duties for oversight, investigations of fraud and other misuse of public funds to the new independent OIG as soon as that new OIG is staffed up and ready to assume those duties.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. And to the testifier, Mr. Bruce, if you would state your name for the record and please begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, MAPE. We are a union of over 18,500 state professionals across all agencies, boards, and commissions, including the OIG staff housed at all of the executive branch agencies. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. House File 1 has some has some interesting issues, particularly regarding the its approach to addressing waste, fraud, and abuse in our system. One of the things that we have been testifying in various committees is specifically to the classification issues that are present here in the bill. What this proposal does is currently strip away essential worker protections and safeguards that ensures employees performing the work are protected from arbitrary or politically motivated dismissals, similar to what we are currently seeing at the federal level. Whether it's intentional or not, the provisions in this bill are reflective of a broader attack on qualified government workers to make it easier to replace them. For those unfamiliar with Minnesota's civil service system, the difference between classified and unclassified service essentially boils down to the hiring and firing procedures that are applicable to them. Classified employees are hired through a merit-based competitive selection process and can only be terminated for just cause. Classified employees covered by collective bargaining agreements, such as the ones being declassified and transferred here, enjoy even greater protections typically reserved for some of the folks who are looking to access the grievance and arbitration procedures that aren't always reflected in the commissioner or the managerial plans. Unclassified employee positions are typically reserved for those whose job requires some duty of loyalty and confidentiality to the agency heads or to political appointees. The language here in this bill stripping OIG employees of their classified service designation and union protections is antithetical to a qualified and independent office of inspector general. Beyond removing the merit-based and competitive hiring processes and protections in this bill, Section 7, Subdivision 3, in fact, gives broader protections to against removal from the OIG than what is afforded to their employees and their deputies. The bill will additionally make administration of grants management and oversight far more difficult for those who are currently doing licensing and oversight in DHS, in MDE, and other agencies, as those aren't strictly within the parameters of an OIG investigation. As Commissioner Campbell highlights in her letter, there's a tremendous amount of interdepartmental and interagency communication and collaboration needed to oversee grants and administer them, from licensing and investigation, that removing them and moving them into a separate agency would only create more siloing and make it harder to solve, that simply embedding these legislative employees now would not solve. Lastly, the bill attempts to consolidate functions by eliminating the OIG offices in several agencies. We've talked in other committees about the issue with eliminating particularly DHS licensing, because they are the only authority that is licensed by the U.S. government, particularly CMS, to administer the Medicaid program. The other part is concerns with siloing and eliminating DCYF. We've seen issues when we were trying to create the agency of Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and how moving one-to-one ratios simply did not work and created more duplicative services that were needed to backfill some of the positions and ensure that those licenses maintained by the agencies did not create federal uncompliance. Finally, House File 1 is a missed opportunity to actually discuss some of the real potentials of creating an independent Inspector General office and collaborating with the agencies as is. We hope that you vote against this bill. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Mr. Bruce. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to see if there's any other public testifiers. We don't have anybody else signed up. Anybody from the public that would like to testify on House File 1? I don't see anybody. And one more time, this is a public meeting. Anybody from the public? With that, Representative Anderson, would you like to make comments to the testimony? And Mr. Bruce, you're welcome to stay up there for that, and then we'll go to member questions. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, thank you, Chair. Mr. Bruce and I, he's been here at every one of my committees. So the main issue was the in the bill, as it stated, it says unclassified for all the employees. That is not the that is not the intent, and will not be what's in the final draft as we're working through each of these. We intend to completely mimic the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I'm sure you're aware, but the this would be a stand, kind of a side-by-side. So you have the legislative auditor who answers to the legislature, who is overseen essentially by the Legislative Audit Commission, and then you will have this OIG that does the same thing. Separate things, but they will answer to the legislature, ultimately through a very, very, very functional, probably the only functional entity of this legislature in the last couple decades from a nonpartisan standpoint. So when I see Representative Quam over here, who will be the vice chair of the commission, Senator Rest is the chair for this year of the Legislative Audit Commission, but it's very functional. So by the time we have our next engrossment, maybe you won't be here. So I will miss you. So, but that is, I just wanted to point that out. We also are working through the DHS licensing. It is not the intent. So different agencies have different things that are, they sort of put under an OIG. Some put a few employees and some put, you know, significantly more, but they don't need to be there. And so it's not our intent to pull out things that should be left within an agency. There really aren't OIG functions, and potentially DHS licensing is one. And we'll be working through that. We want to make this work. This has to work. And so it's going to be it's a project that we're all going to do together. So, thank you.
Very good. And with that, members, let's go to questions. And just a reminder, Mr. Sullivan laid out the area this affects Department of Education and why it's in education finance. The bill has gone through State Gov, Health and Human Services, and we'll be going to Judiciary next. So we're going to try to keep within those jurisdictions. So Representative Lee, you're the first one.
Great. Thank you, Chair. I just want to follow up on some of the commentary from the author and Mr. Bruce. As we noted, we have this bill because on page 17, what would happen is if this bill were to pass, this new office would absorb the OIG that we created at MDE. And so I just want to know for folks who may not remember, the OIG staff at MDE right now is classified. And so I just think for the author, it would have been helpful to have an amendment that you could engross in this committee staff, because we are talking about MDE staff who are currently classified. So my question is to Mr. Bruce on like what this would look like in this transition, because I also know the implementation date of this bill is also very, very fast. And you know, I'm just curious what that would look like on the staff end and what that would do to the investigations and data that they currently have at MDE.
And so if I'm hearing you correctly, Representative Lee, you're asking what the implementation would look like specifically related to the lines 17.18 on page 17, is that correct? Is that what you're asking?
With an emphasis on moving from classified to unclassified.
With an emphasis on classified and unclassified. Representative Anderson, or to the testifier, who would like to take that? Representative Anderson, we'll start with you.
Sure, and I have to look up the lines, but I think the way the Legislative Audit Office is set up, the top staff, the auditor, the top deputies, which is the same within agencies, are unclassified, and the rest of the staff is classified. That's the norm, even within every one of our state agencies. And I expect that this will be set up that same way. Where does the MDE OIG, you know, person fit? That's not going to be the top of the agency. But that's probably my guess, is that will end up be as some sort of a deputy commissioner that oversees education, or deputy OIG that oversees education. We are not trying to completely dictate all the structure of this agency, because we believe how many different staff and this, how many different, because we believe we need to leave it to the OIG, him or herself, to help form that, just like we do with commissioners. We do the same thing within state agencies with commissioners. But that would be my expectation. that it would be laid out exactly like it is in other, in the legislative audit or the legislative auditor's office and within most of our agency offices.
Representative Lee, follow up.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I actually do want to hear from Mr. Bruce because, I mean, we've heard claims from the author that this new office would be set up like the OLA, but again, the legislative auditor has testified in numerous committees and has been on record stating that she and her entire staff are classified, and that's a really important protection so that they can maintain the integrity of their office. And so I want to note that, again, at MDE right now, the way that the OAG has been created is to make sure that those staff are classified so that they can conduct their thorough work in an independent manner. My question goes to Mr. Bruce. For the folks at MDE right now, if they were to do this transition from classified to unclassified, what does that look like and how does that impact the staff and also the investigations that they do?
Mr. Bruce, would you like to comment on the classification status presented by Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just really quickly to go back, because I know that Representative Anderson's looking for the statute, is specifically the OLA, deputy OLA, and the confidential secretaries are in the unclassified service. The rest of the staff are in the classified service. For this, it would be, there's essentially three different issues happening. One, they're being declassified. Under Minnesota statutes, when an employee is declassified, they are actually remain in classified service for up to 1 year. So there is a functional prohibition on transferring them into unclassified service when they have been declassified. The second is stripping them of their collective bargaining rights. Currently, under Minnesota statutes, making them a legislative employee does not automatically make them covered by collective bargaining rights. And in specific examples, they are expressly prohibited from having collective bargaining rights. Third is the transfer of duties and the backfilling. When an employee is transferred, particularly with the effective dates currently here, there is usually a need to hand off the whatever projects, et cetera, that they are working on. So either more temporary employees will need to be brought on to handle those functions to ensure that no cases are missed or that the work continues. But there is going to be some gap, and I'm not sure if MDE has any other recollections of this, but when we were putting together the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, there was an offloading and significant input and outreach to impacted agencies to provide a just transition to ensure that no gaps were filled. And in many cases today, they are still transitioning employees from DHS and other agencies into Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Chaos is what it would look like.
Representative Anderson, do you have a comment?
He's right. At the top, it's what I had said earlier. It's the top management that is essentially unclassified, and the rest are classified. And we intend to mimic that. So it's just like any agency, just like the legislative auditor's office, it would be mimicked. I don't know how many employees are in children, youth, and family, but it's significantly more than what this office will have, the transfer that was done. And I wasn't involved in that, but I have been involved in agency transfers in my previous life. I actually was a commissioner of a no longer existing employee department called the Department of Employee Relations under the second Plenty administration. And I actually broke that agency apart and merged it into several other agencies, HHS, health. Most of it went to what's management and budget now. And we did that without any layoffs, and we did that without anyone losing their classifications, and that's the intent. So I have a history. I've done this for you weren't here, but others, your older folk, you probably know. And this could be done right, so, and it needs to get done.
Representative Lee, one more follow-up, if you have any. You don't have to.
I mean, it's okay. No, but, you know, given the author said, you know, she has experience doing this, splitting up agencies, I mean, is the implementation date of this bill what you intend it to be? Because I just think it won't, it won't be a long enough time for an on-ramp.
Representative Anderson,
thank you, Representative Lee. It's the language in here. Essentially, the handoff will occur when the new OIG says that they're ready. So the handoff doesn't have to occur exactly on the, you know, July 1 of whatever. So within the, and I'll go through and find the language. But we understand that.
All right. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Krisha, and thank you for bringing the bill, Representative Anderson. I have four quick questions. I promise to be very brief, but I want to touch on a couple of elements of the bill. It has to do with scale, timeline, and, and feasibility of both. First question is a really quick one. You know, the scale of what this bill is proposing seems to be a little unclear. Are we talking about an office that is going to examine and regulate and oversee grants, or is it all government expenditures?
Representative Anderson, to the scale of the implementation.
Thank you. And I should find the actual language, but it's the recipient of state funds. So if you look at 3.8, subdivision 8, an entity or person, that receives, that's the wrong language. It's essential, it's not all state funding. This is essentially the recipients, outside recipients. Generally are businesses, they are nonprofits, or in some cases are actual grantees.
Representative
Hill. Recipients of those funds.
Representative Hill, to your second question.
Thank you, Chair Krisha. And the second element here that I drew up in my wonderings has to do with the approximately 30,000 grants that are out there statewide that Deed shared that it would alone require a minimum of 850 site visits on an annual basis and as many as 2,000 or more. How many staff members do you foresee that would require to achieve that number of site visits?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. We had that discussion at the last committee with HHS, and they are doing on-site visits now in person. And the question was, well, if they're all over the state, how can they be done? This was a question from one of your fellow members. I mentioned that I own a business. I own a whole chain of salons in the Twin Cities, and we're licensed by the Board of Cosmetology. And we pay a couple hundred bucks a year for a license. And they show up at least once a year, unannounced, and everyone goes, and the board's here. And, and then they go through and they do their inspection and they write a report. And that is all paid for with my couple hundred dollar, license fee. So they're doing that now, and there are way more people licensed by the Board of Cosmetology than ever were in these grants. So if you, many multiple times more than what would have site visits now. But they are being done now. Site visits are being done now. They weren't being done before, and that is a huge part of why we had all the problems and all the fraud that we had. And as we all know, if they would have just done site visits to the meal, feeding our future, this would have stopped. We would have never gotten to $250 million in fraud in feeding our future. Site visits is very important. Unannounced site visits are very important. And we all want, the best. We create programs because there's a need. And we want to serve folks, whether it's meals or whether it's serve any kind of autism, different services. We're looking at there's issues with all the child care now. And we had our fraud committee had a hearing on that. We've all seen everything in the news about all that. Those are dollars that could have gone to people who actually need the services. And, we need to, especially in the budget times we have now, we need to make sure those dollars are going to people that we serve. So I'm not concerned at all about site visits. They're being done, and even if there's 4,000 more, it's part of the job.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Krisha, and thank you for the response, Representative Anderson. You and I have that in common. We believe in the value and the importance of the site visits. This gets at the feasibility of the staff, the number of staff, the timeline is what I want to touch on next. The timeline for implementation for this bill is July 1 of this year. And the question is, how could it be possible to implement this challenging task on a short timeline? How would it be possible to have the inspectors in place to achieve these site visits on an annual basis?
Representative Anderson to the timeline.
Thank you, Representative Hale. And I apologize, I don't have that section. Maybe you can you help me, numbers? The section.
And Representative Hale, let's go to your fourth question while we look that up and we'll come back to it.
Thank you, Chair Carisha. And one more, Representative Anderson. The last layer is related to that.
Yeah.
And it has to do with, at this point, there are $0 appropriated for the current fiscal year. How is it possible to create and staff up and begin the work of a new agency if there are no dollars appropriated?
Representative Anderson, to the dollars. Then I'm going to go to Mr. Sullivan for the timeline. So Representative answer this one first, then we'll come back.
Thank you, I will. First of all, a lot of this is moving existing staff. And although I understand you, this bill does embed staff within agencies too, but they're embedded means they're experts in that. Maybe they're housed, you know, within certain agencies that need that. It also allows, if you recall, I think it was last year or the year before, the agencies were talking about that they needed help in administering grants. And we gave them the authority to take essentially, it's a 5 to 10 or 5 to 15% of grants for administrative dollars. This bill gives 1% to the OIG. And I believe as we're working through, you know, all the fine details, of which there are many, as you can imagine, in this, that we'll have to, that will more than cover any additional costs. There will, it's my intent that there will be no cost to the general fund on this. So, and
Mr. Sullivan, would you like to help us out on?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, on page 17, section 12, this is the portion of the bill that abolishes the existing duties within three named state agencies, including the Department of Education, and transfers them to the Office of the Inspector General. While this Section 12 does take effect on July 1st, 2025, the language here in Subdivision 1 provides that the actual transfer of authority and the abolishment of the duties within the agencies does not incur until, and this starts on 17.22, the day after the Inspector General certifies in writing to the Commissioner of the respective department and the Commissioner of Management and Budget that the Inspector General has assumed responsibility for these duties.
Yep. Representative Anderson, would you like to clarify that?
Yep, thank you. So that clarifies that question. The bill becomes effective, and then there will be a time frame, and it will be done. It was just like essentially how we did Dewar. The bill became effective, and we took about, I can't remember, 15 months to actually make the transfers, move folks, because it's got to be done right again. So.
And Representative Anderson and Mr. Sullivan, just so we're all super clear on the record, so the certification starts on line 17.22 all the way down to 17.25, and it is with written documents and the assumption of the responsibility. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Chair Joachim, I'm going to let you jump in with some questions and then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first question would be to you. I know that this bill doesn't have a fiscal note, and while I appreciate the authors saying that it's not going to cost anything, it still is changing the budget in MDE. So once we get a fiscal note, will this bill be back before us?
Chair Joachim, so I've talked to Ways and Means, I've talked to the author, and I've been very clear that if this is going to change anything in education finance, it would have to come back through here, and we'll see what that looks like or what the Ways and Means wants to do. But, yes, I think the intent, if we have a financial impact, it should have to circle back through and make sure we do that correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I'll, Representative Anderson, I have just a few questions for you. Just we have talked, and I do appreciate that. And I mentioned that you should look at the MDE language to see what we've done with definitions, because I know those can be tricky. And I share your passion to get something like this taken care of, because that's what we did in MDE over the last 2 years. Because we know feeding our future should never happen again. We do know that it happened during a global pandemic, and with things, more money coming in that the agency might not have been able to handle. That explains it. doesn't excuse it. So they're on the right path here. But I'm a little worried about a few different things. So my first question is, I know you and I talked a lot about definitions, mm-hmm. because I think that's one of the hard things about having an overall inspector general, because those definitions look different at each agency. The way they, DHS does not look like MDE in the way they function with money. DHS has a lot more pass-through from the feds. MDE is constitutionally required to fund education. So the money passing forth in grants are to our schools, which this would cover, money to our public schools, charter schools, the non-public people aid we do, all that is under things the department doles out that would be underneath this umbrella, and we were really thoughtful about that when we put the MDE together. Mm-hmm. So on page 5.2, you use the word misuse, and I didn't see a definition for misuse anywhere.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, and thank you, Lead Joachim. I actually changed waste and abuse and changed it to misuse because waste, I think, is subjective, frankly. We all have different definitions of waste. Mine's probably more than others. abuse is also less subjective, but slightly subjective. And so we kind of combine those terms, and so we're now fraud and misuse. And I think that's much clearer. And so we did that throughout the entire bill when we did the last amendment.
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, I still don't see a definition of misuse, though, in the bill.
In here somewhere.
And Mr. Sullivan, do you have something at the ready with that?
Mr. Chair and members, when the author last amended the bill at the prior committee stop, as Representative Anderson mentioned, the definitions for abuse and waste were eliminated and replaced. The term was replaced throughout with the term misuse or other unlawful use of public funds without definitions for the new terms.
Oh. Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that does worry me because there's no definition of misuse, and the definitions mean a lot because as I listened to all the committee stops this bill went through, and a lot of concern was around what exactly was fraud or misuse, or mostly misuse, because that could be an agency or that could be a recipient of money or a grant that just made a bookkeeping error or it's a correctable violation. And you have that second line in 5.3 saying misuse or other unlawful use of public funds to the appropriate law enforcement entity. So would that mean that you're sending a correctable violation to a law enforcement entity? Because the language directs you to do that. And I'm thinking in the educational realm. Don't need to pick on Robbinsdale, I'm sorry, but their school district double counted their compensatory aid and found a $20 million mistake in their budget, which is a lot, and they're trying to correct that right now. That was a bookkeeping error, so should they have been reported to law enforcement?
Thank you, Lead Joachim.
Representative Anderson. So, Representative Joachim, thank you for the nice breaking ball that brings it back in the strike zone with education. Representative Anderson.
Misuse is it should be defined as something very intentional, and we'll ask nonpartisan staff who's helped craft these definitions to continue to add that definition as you want into this bill. Since we did take out waste and we did take out abuse.
And Representative Anderson, just a thought for that as I'm thinking through this conversation, and thank you for the Robbinsdale, but you might just want to consider whether or not the use of intentional before misuse is there.
Thank you.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll try to keep it in the realm of education, too, because that's where I know the MDE OIG from. So,
you're doing fine.
Also, and I know this is going to judiciary, and thank you for that, because putting my hat, Senate staff hat on from a long time ago, I worked in that area. And I know Chapter 13 is paramount when it comes to dealing with data and privacy. And on line 5.17, you have giving the commissioner or chief executive officer of an agency must provide full and unrestricted access to all government data, regardless of classification created and maintained by the agency. I'm wondering what parameters they have on that data and how far they can go in an investigation, because it doesn't seem in the language to be attached to a specific investigation. And I know on one of the other committees, I think it was Representative Howard that brought up a very good point. If you were looking at a school, let's say it's even a, let's say it's Robbinsdale again. Sorry, Representative Freiberg. But let's say you did decide that it was a misuse for them to double count the compensatory, and they had all access to data at that school without parameters. All that data also goes into families that have data at that school. Would they be notified that their data has been given to an inspector? I'm glad it's going to judiciary, and I would just want you to think about some of those implications when you're looking at that, when they start talking about Chapter 13, which is almost as complicated as the education formula, but not quite. And then I had a question along the data, too, when you go to judiciary. Section 7.11 and 7.14, you completely opt out the inspector general from all of Chapter 13. Or maybe nonpartisan staff can tell me if I'm reading that right.
Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Chair and Representative Joachim, on page 7, lines 7.15 to 7.18, those provide that the inspector general would be subject to Chapter 13 Government Data Practices Act and would be required to protect data from unlawful disclosure.
Thank you. Maybe you can explain to me 7.11 to 7.14 then. Am I reading it backwards?
And Representative Anderson, if you could do that quickly, or did you want Mr. Sullivan?
Mr.
Sullivan, if you could.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joachim, lines 7.11 and 7.18 work together as sort of a package. 7.11 clarifies again that the Inspector General, like the Legislative Auditor, has access to all government data regardless of classification. Paragraph B provides that if a state employee then provides classified or not public data to the OIG, they are not violating Chapter 13 by doing so. And then paragraph C, 7.15 through 7.18, assert that the Inspector General is subject to Chapter 13.
Chair Joachim, and I'm sure this will get talked about in the judiciary, but
thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move off the data piece then. Sometimes I miss that subsection, and I'm still concerned that it doesn't have enough parameters about the investigation and how far you can go in. So maybe they'll have you look at that too, is that it should be very tailored to the data that you need for the investigation and not all that daisy chain email there. And we kind of talk about that if you look at the language that you're repealing from MDE, how to keep that a little tighter. And then the last thing I would have, and I thank you, Representative Hill, for asking the questions about when this transfer would happen, because I was a little concerned, too, with Section 12 having to happen July 1st, 2025. But hearing that, there'll still be a process after that. And maybe that's how I'll end with some of my questions, is that process. This is something that should take a really long time to be done, longer than this session that we're having, longer definitely than the deadlines we'll have for policy and budget. Just as an example, when we set up the MDEOIG, they got rolling. We gave them 2023. We gave them the money. They finally hired somebody in the winter of 23. And by the following year, in 2024, we put more definitions around what they were going to do. They started taking complaints, though, January of 2024. And that's why they were working with definitions with us. And they've done really well. They've had 140 complaints. They closed 80. There's 60 still open. But it took 2 years to get that set up. You look at the transition for Department of Children, Youth, and Families. That was 3. And they're still cleaning that up. And we're talking about moving a lot of people around with this bill. Even when you look at, we'll be talking about standards later this week, that takes about 2 to 3 years. This is a big change. And while I really do think something needs to be done, I'm just worried this is being rushed and it's not quite hitting the mark yet, because words really matter when it comes to this, especially if you're opening investigations. If you don't have things tight enough, you could make it unable to be charged in criminal court. You could not get the money back. You could have violations. And I really highly suggest everybody read both MDE's letter and MMB's letter when it comes to that and how the effects this could have if things aren't done right. And that's all in our packet. But I hope you talk to MDE directly, the four members that you're working with, as you're going through this transition, because I think they'd have a lot of good suggestions. And I appreciate being here. Thank you.
And members, I have a couple more people on the question. At 2 o'clock, we are going to go to closing this bill, so we do have one more. And so just because there's a pause doesn't mean you have to think of questions. You can always catch Representative Anderson outside of the committee. Representative Vernig, then Representative Ingen, then Representative Green. So Representative Vernig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Kwong, for the use of your microphone. I seem to pick the wrong spot today.
Bipartisanship at its finest. Representative Vernon.
Yes. And I asked a series of questions in the last time I saw this bill. I do have a question based on that sort of came to me today based on the letter from Commissioner Jett, I believe. Yes, from Commissioner Jett. Could you describe the difference? So in the bill, I have some strong feelings about the monitoring visits. I don't disagree that they need to occur. Former OSHA investigator here. The difference between a monitoring visit and Commissioner Jett, he talks about conducting investigations, including criminal activity. What is a monitoring visit versus, say, an investigation? Or how do you see that working?
Representative Anderson, monitoring visiting.
Thank you.
Monitoring visit.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have not seen his letter, so maybe it came over my email or maybe it just went to the members of this committee, but I haven't seen it. But I'll be just broadly answer your question like that. Monitoring visits are when you show up unannounced and see if there's actually kids eating food. So a investigative is when there is, thank you, when there is cause to believe that there is fraud or other issues, misuse of funds going on, and you're in the middle of an investigation. So that's very different. So,
and Representative Vernon, I did give her a copy of the letter, so if you guys want to take that, you don't have to read it in front of us now. That's, you know, give you some time. Representative Vernon, quick follow-up.
So I am a little concerned about how this is structured in your bill and that there may need to be more. As you referenced earlier, you do own salons, and you referenced that in the last committee. So I actually looked up 2105.0115 and 2110.0125, where they talk about inspections. Both they identify protocols, violations, and orders to comply, posting results, inspection penalties and discipline, application of inspection penalties. And 2110 even goes on to talk about reinstatement after suspension or revocation. So, as I mentioned in the last committee, OSHA uses 182.659. I feel like this is an area that we could flush out a little bit more. I know you talked about leaving this open more for the department to regulate, but I do think some guidelines around inspections is key. Because if it's not structured properly and not staffed appropriately, you will end up with drive-by inspections or site visits or monitoring visits. You know, so I do think that there should be something more here. So thank you.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. It's sorely needed. It seems like every single day we're seeing a new headline of a new breaking story that includes more fraud. We're kind of disillusioned to it at this point. But one of the questions that I wanted to revert back to and see if this would be a potential amendment that you consider bringing forward, have the OIG hire outside private counsel or actors to aid in their investigatory actions. So if you're looking for the feasibility of conducting those site visits, maybe a contract with a private investigative firm or a private forensic auditing firm, that might be beneficial in kind of streamlining that process. And then the question that I had, Mr. Chair, can the OIG bring forward civil or criminal complaints?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Ingen and Mr. Chair. This office will probably refer civil and criminal complaints. They'll do the investigative, but I suspect most of the prosecution will be done by the Attorney General, by the feds, by county attorneys. Thanks.
Representative Engen, quick follow-up, or are you good?
I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Green, then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this bill forward. I know there's no doubt we need tight oversight. I just want to follow up on Representative Joachim's question about the definitions, and I was thrilled to see that, that the changes were made from the first engrossment to now, so thank you. My question is, like, how do we determine if an action is, or an expenditure falls under misuse or if it falls under fraud? And I know, like, that might seem very nuanced, but I think that's part of what we need to clarify in this bill so that it's very clear. It's very clear when that's in violation, just because I think objectively, and I know I heard you say it, sometimes it is subjective and sometimes it's intention, but I think the more that we do that, I do think on the back end, holding, you know, different providers accountable for that, it will help us. And so I just wanted to say that. So I don't know if you want to respond to that, but
so Representative Green, are you looking for clarification or is this something that you'd like to see work done?
I would like to see this work done.
Representative Anderson, would that be something you could work on?
Thank you, and we will. And nonpartisan will work on this too.
Excellent.
Thank you. As a definition. So
very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And I think Mr. Sullivan is working hard. He may have this by, no, I'm kidding. Representative Johnson, Representative Bonner, and then we'll go to close.
You, thank you, Chair. Krisha, Representative, that was one thing that stuck out to me too, was the subjective or objective nature of that word misuse. And one concern I would have too, and cleaning this up might help avoid it, but how those complaints come in, if a parent is concerned about misuse because a certain topic is being taught in their school and they file a complaint and they have to search those things out, like trying to basically stop a flood of complaints and like gripes about something they don't like as misuse being used as an excuse to try and, you know, get something stopped at their school, and try to make sure it just doesn't flood out the legitimate complaints and work that's going on. So I'm glad to hear that you're willing to at least work on that and kind of clean up that definition a bit. The other thing I just wanted to ask about was when we talk about recipients of state funds and then tying that into those in-person inspections, with those, and this is just for clarification for me, with those pass-through funds, if that money goes from an agency to a nonprofit and then that nonprofit does work in a school, is that visit happening at the nonprofit? Is the visit happening at the school? Is it every step of the process, or is it just the end user of those dollars?
Representative Anderson, do you have an answer?
Thank you. I think a lot of that will be their prerogative, the Inspector General. I found the language in the meantime. Sorry, the bill's too thick. Recipient of state funds includes but is not limited to a private person or entity currently or formerly under contract with the state to provide benefits, goods, or services to eligible recipients. So the recipients aren't. It's the entity that's under contract, whether that is a school, whether that's a daycare center, whether that's a meal provider. You know, we can go on and on and on, but that is the recipient. So it's the people we're hiring, whether they're paid for in grant dollars or in general fund dollars. We are hiring them to do something for our constituents, for our citizens of Minnesota, that we think needs to get done to provide a service. So all we're doing is we're overseeing to make sure that they're actually doing what we hired them to do. That's what this is. And I think that's what the citizens expect. Thank you.
Representative Johnson, quick follow-up, or are you good?
I'm good.
Okay. Representative Bonner, and then I'm going to go to Chair Joachim for a close. Representative Bonner.
So I'm actually just going to make some comments, less questions. Well, maybe one question. I'll end with that one. But the first is, you know, I appreciate that we all want to do something about fraud. I think there's no disagreement there. Every dollar that doesn't go where it needs to go is a dollar that could have been used efficiently, right? And I think no matter what side of the aisle you're on, we all agree on that. I do have real concerns about the independence of the OIG as it's set up under this bill. I think there's some discrepancies with the Senate and how that plays out. which is a real problem. I also worry about the classification of employees and how that might impact their independence and what that looks like. So I have real issues there. I also have concerns about the data piece, what that looks like as someone who works within the technology space, and we see some rampant abuses happening in certain parts right now. I'm not going to go down that road, but I think what it says to me is that we should have greater clarity around how people's data is being accessed, what's being accessed, and have some accountability for that. And just leaving it open doesn't feel very good to me as a technology professional. I also want to say the site visits versus a monitored visit. I know that the staff said that there was a very big difference between just a staff visit to say, yep, you really exist, versus monitoring visits. There was a big conversation about how much staff would be required to do that and the timelines to bring that staff online, which is probably not reasonable within the timelines of this bill and when it would come about. So I have some serious issues there, not to mention I don't know how we're going to pay for all those additional staff to do these visits, and I don't see that accounted for in the bill. So I have questions there. And the last one is really a question for you. But during that conversation, we, and I appreciate that you've been willing to work with folks, but during that, we actually accepted a Howard Amendment around conflict of interest. And I do not see that in this bill. It appears to have been edited out. And I think it's a really important piece to make sure that we have that conflict of interest and code of ethics in place. And I'm not sure why it would have been stripped out, if you could speak to that.
And let me go. Mr. Sullivan, do you have insight on that before we want to make sure that that's an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair and members, so I staffed the state government committee as well. The author accepted an amendment in that committee that removed grants management provisions from the bill. That's offhand the only adopted amendment that I remember in that committee, but maybe Representative Bonner's referring to action in human services.
And let me come out. Representative Anderson, if you can comment.
Thank you, Representative. If it was not intentional. It was a drafting error. So I found it. I actually have way too much stuff here. This would have been on the 17th, Subdivision 5, Conflicts of Interest Code of Ethics. So I guess we need to find that.
I'm actually going to cut this one off because this may happen outside. I want to make sure we get this right. It's not something we'd fix here anyway. Yeah. If we can go back through and make sure that we have it, and then whatever amendment you need to fix, because I'll just leave it there. I'm not going to go into it. I think that that's something that will be fixed outside this committee. So thank you for calling that out. Mm-hmm. Chair Joaquim, to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this bill. We all agree that Feeding Our Futures never should have happened, and necessity is the mother of invention, and that is why MDE worked so hard to set up an Office of Inspector General that is functioning very well. While it was a very creative suggestion from Representative Engen, hiring outside private investigators that don't have knowledge base in the area that they're investigating probably isn't the greatest idea and probably would be more expensive. It's very important when we go into our schools that and daycares and all the other areas that receive money from the state that they know what they're looking at, because numbers can look one way and you may not understand the underlying impetus or language around them. That being said, I know as this is moving very rapidly, in my opinion too rapidly, we have 9 weeks left in session and the House and Senate bill are structured very differently down to what part of the government it's gonna be under. And I have a suggestion that might make it easier, besides the definitions and really tightening things up, is since you have a OIG and MDE and DHS that have been functioning and have the subject matter expert and they have 80% of our state budget, have you thought about keeping those in place while you structure? They will be in place until you finish the structure, but like keeping them under the structure and having the OIG have the oversight of the other agencies that don't have functioning OIGs in them. So that's just a suggestion, and I can't just reiterate enough, this should take a few years to get done. I think we are not going to get this done in 9 weeks. Good luck.
Mm-hmm. So, members, in consultation, thank you, Representative Bonner. So, you know, I want to make sure that it wasn't nothing was intentional. It was a misstep, and I want to make sure I don't call out staff or anything for that. So, actually, what I would like to propose, this was adopted, and if it's okay with you, Representative Anderson, I would have Mr. Sullivan read the language, and we, if you would take that as a friendly amendment, we would just adopt that and make sure that goes into the bill. Is that acceptable to you, Representative Bonner? So, Chair Kreisha moves the oral amendment as to be read by Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, the language, Representative Bonner was correct. The Howard Amendment was divided in state government, and the first half was adopted. That must not have been conveyed to the reviser in the committee report. So the language that the chair is moving to add the language to the second engrossment would be on page 3, after line 32, insert subdivision 5, conflicts of interest, semicolon, code of ethics, period. The inspector general, comma, deputy inspector general, comma, assistant inspectors general, comma, and all other employees of the office are public officials for purposes of the conflict of interest and statement of economic disclosure requirements in Chapter 10A and are subject to the code of ethics in Section 43A.38 where applicable.
Thank you. And so, members, this was already adopted, and I'm going to go ahead and move us to adoption of that. Do you have a quick comment, Representative Bonner?
Do we need to renumber the sequencing, the line, the next line, renumber the subdivisions in sequence?
And so I'll direct staff to go ahead and do the renumbering as appropriate. Okay, so members, all those in favor of adopting the oral amendment, which will be staff will renumber and make sure this is correct for the next engrossment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The oral amendment is adopted. Thank you for the catch. And we have the close. Representative Anderson, final comments before we go to a vote?
We're over time, so I ask your support, and we can get this done. This will take a year and a half probably to implement because that's what it took on others. But it's very doable, and this is much less of a work than what we've done with children and families, and significantly less than what we did with Doer. So it's very doable, and it has to get done. So
thank you, Representative Anderson. The chair renews the motion that House File 1 be re-referred as amended to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? You're on your way. With that, I'm going to ask Representative Bakeford to come up, and I'll take House File 779 from the testifiers. I got it right here. Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you, sir. I'll take this one ahead. This one later.
Chair Kreisha, I'll give you a moment to get settled in.
Ready.
Thank you, Chair Kreisha. While you get yourself situated, Chair Kreisha moves House File 779 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. Chair Kreisha, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Bakeberg. And so with that, members, what we have, we've seen fraud in child care and through the CCAP and other nutritional programs. Obviously, we are the stewards of the taxpayer dollars. And so knowing that fraud is real, pervasive, and persistent, and that victims are oftentimes caught in unsuspecting situations, and these are our parents, our children, and they're really being denied services that are intended to support them. And so one of the most recent scams involves recruiting and putting parents in a position where they might unknowingly sign their children up for substandard tutoring services and signing away their rights to tax refunds or inviting a tax audit. This is made worse when the Department of Revenue treats the parents like potential criminals rather than nonprofits, or the tutoring centers seeking these are doing unsavory tactics. As detailed in recent news reports, and you have a couple of those in your folders, we have a scheme where apparently the conduct with no due diligence on the educational partners provided tutoring or other services that was substandard. In the end, the child is denied legitimate education. The parent is essentially robbed of their entitled tax refunds, while these entities and their tutoring partners appear to be paid in full. That doesn't seem to be right. It's not right. This bill seeks to address two problems. First, the financial reality that many families cannot afford to pay the upfront cost of the educational benefits covered by the tax credit. So the first thing we have to solve is they have to come up with this money for these, and that can be a very difficult situation. Second, shutting down the K-12 credit assignment program that these entities use to bankroll their fraud. I will be the first to admit the bill is the start of the conversation. As you can see, I'm the only author. I'd love to have other offers. The advance payment option included in the bill likely has a cost that needs to be determined through a fiscal note, which is why we'll be laying this over. And there might still be a place for legitimate actors to use the K-12 assignment program to help eligible parents. So we have to get this right. This bill, based on the model established with the child tax credit, provides lower income qualifying families with the option to seek an advance payment of up to half the eligible education tax credit. And the bill ends the K-12 assignment program, which would no longer be needed if the parents effectively have the cash in hand to pay for legitimate educational expenses. The bill would examine whether the educational tax credit could be provided to eligible families through an electronic benefits transfer card that would work like a debit card similar to how families access SNAP benefits. I should have with us some qualified House resource staff to help answer technical questions about the current tax credit, including family eligibility and qualifying expenses. And so with that, I do believe I have a couple testifiers, and as I said, I'd like to start the conversation on the bill and see if we can get some support.
Members, we have two testifiers. I will call forward Mr. Omar and Mr. Shaver. You guys can both come up if you're here. When recognized by the chair, I will ask the testifiers to identify themselves for the record. And any organizations you might be representing. I will ask you to keep your comments to about 3 minutes. We can be a little flexible on the time for you. All right. Mr. Omar, do you want to go first? If you'd please identify yourself for the public record.
Hi, everyone. My name is Afshar Omar, and thank you for this opportunity. I wanted to speak on this bill because, like most of you, I read those reports from Sahan Journal and Minnesota Reformer. And it's a really unfortunate situation to see families, especially low-income families, who are struggling to get their children a better education, right? Families that understood that their children are falling behind. And it's a clear statistic in this state that our children are not doing as well as children in other states. You can refer back to the Minnesota Fed report a few years ago about reading, writing, math, things of that nature. And these parents found out about a program that is able to provide free tutoring for their children. And that's what they were told, at least, in the report. Many of these families, the 18 mothers that came forward. But what turned out to be a grant program was exactly this program that we're talking about today. And basically people, unscrupulous people who saw an opportunity to make a quick buck, not only making a quick buck, but abusing labor all the way on the other side of the planet, right? We're worried about workers in Shein factories not making enough money. We're looking at tutors making $5 an hour for a program that's pretty lucrative when you look at it. And these parents need their tax return. They use this money for repairing their vehicles, paying for healthcare expenses, clothing, and many other different things for their families, right? These are people that live paycheck to paycheck. And when I heard about this bill, I thought this is a wonderful idea. Cut the middleman out, educate the parents directly, and have them have the opportunity to direct the funds directly without having to go through a nonprofit or a foundation and not having to rely on the service provider, like that was reported in the articles, and taking their own word and testimony for it. Is the program good? Absolutely. I think every child that needs additional assistance when it comes to their education, I think that's something that we should support 100%, making sure our kids are able to read, do math, understand science, I think is important for the state, it's important for our workforce, but more importantly, it's good for creating a society that is, you know, cognizant, that can critically think. I think that's a good thing for our society. But the problem is, And this is a cyclical issue that we're seeing relating to fraud. The biggest fraud that occurred in this state, Feeding Our Future, I was directly involved with. I was a senior consultant for the organization. I came in about on the last 5-6 months before the raid occurred. And the funny thing is, when I joined Feeding Our Future, the first thing I did was do an internal audit. And I sent an email to the executive director highlighting 10 organizations that I thought were highly suspicious. And the first thing that happened was my access to the email server and the database was cut the following day. Then we have the raid that occurred a few months later. But before that, I held training sessions with all of these sites and all of the providers, and I said, hey, a lot of this math is not adding up, and we want to start looking at accountability, what's going on, and if you don't come to these trainings, you're going to be immediately cut from the program. Everybody showed up. Some of these things were recorded. And as you know, the feds came in and investigated and shut a lot of these people down, and some people went to jail. And the funny thing that happened was I start seeing my name being printed in the Reformer, in the Star Tribune, saying, am I involved with the fraud? Abshir Omar, political organizer, political strategist, he was consulting for this organization. Is he part of the fraud? What's going on? And almost 3 years later, have I been called as a witness? No. Have I been investigated? No. Have I been charged in any way? No. What we're seeing is these frauds occur again and again and again, and it seems like the state of Minnesota is not doing enough to investigate, is not doing enough to find out what's going on with our tax dollars, right? And when we're looking at this article, one organization named is Daro Faru, right? The providers for success tutoring are involved in this organization. Guess what? They were also involved in Feeding Our Future. One of the key organizers for the organization pled guilty and was charged 17 years in jail, right? What also do we see? These parents asking the Attorney General's office to investigate, and the article states what? No comment. Well, guess who's a big financial supporter of Keith Ellison when he's campaign financing? A lot of the leadership at Daro Faru. There's a lot of questions going on here, right? People are asking what's going on with our tax dollars. How are we investigating this? How are we protecting parents, right? I don't want to go over my time, but I want to support this bill because it cuts the middlemen out. It allows parents to know exactly what they're spending their money on. This is not a grant. This is an advance on your tax return. And guess what? You can spend it with the organization that helps teach your children. Thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony. Mr. Shaver. Mr. Shaver, go ahead.
Chair Bakeberg, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Shaver. I'm the Senior Policy Director at Ed Allies. We work in partnership with families, students, educators to leverage policy to improve outcomes for kids. Thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts on House File 779, and thank you to Representative Krisha for opening up space for this important conversation. As has already been noted, families got ripped off here. I want to use our time before the committee to focus on one element of the fraud that deserves this committee's attention. According to the reporting from the Sahan Journal and the Minnesota Reformer, the tutoring itself was lousy. In the wake of the pandemic's impact on student learning, Minnesota hasn't done enough to scale up statewide tutoring supports for students. There are a number of proven providers that are evidence-based operating in the state right now, like Reading and MathCorps, but they're not in every school and not available statewide. There's absolutely a need for outside-of-school time tutoring that's affordable so that additional support is not only accessible to wealthy families. If the intent of legislative proposals like House File 779 is to reform the K-12 tax credit in order to prevent fraud, one way of doing that is to set a high enough bar so that crooks and opportunists decide it's more trouble than it's worth to try and set up tutoring operations. A positive side effect of raising that bar will be making it easier for families to find evidence-based tutoring so their kids can actually get the help they need. Right now, the standard for tutoring for the K-12 tax credit is woefully inadequate and should be updated to include policies aligned with evidence for what we know drives learning gains from tutoring. High-dosage tutoring needs to be done in person, multiple times a week, provide frequent standards-based progress reports to families, be accessible to students with disabilities. For literacy, the curriculum and instruction should be aligned to the science of reading. Each tutor should not be working with more than 5 students at a time. Tutors should be paid at least minimum wage, and there should be ongoing statewide monitoring of effectiveness and alignment to standards. Additionally, families being audited by the Department of Revenue with financial penalties hanging over their heads if they can't prove whether or not the tutors working with their children were qualified or prove that the instruction was standards-based is way too high of a bar. I'm a licensed elementary school teacher, and I had to double check just now whether fluently adding and subtracting fractions with unlike denominators was a fourth or fifth grade math standard. Expecting families to prove, potentially years later, that the tutoring their kids got while they weren't in the room was aligned to grade level standards or literally face a financial penalty from the Department of Revenue is frankly ridiculous. The burden of proof should be with the tutoring company hoping to get state funds to demonstrate it as high quality and staffed with qualified tutors. And if not, they should be the ones paying financial penalties, not families who are scammed. In this situation, families of struggling students went out of their way and went above and beyond for their kids to seek out additional academic support. In addition to having money stolen from them, their kids didn't get the help they needed. That's devastating, and it's unacceptable. Kids deserve better. So we strongly encourage the legislature to raise the bar for what constitutes qualifying tutoring to make sure this doesn't happen again. We're eager to partner in determining how to align research on high dosage tutoring with policy and oversight. Again, thank you to Representative Kreischer for authoring the bill. Thank you all for your service to the state.
Thank you all for your testimony. Public testimony is now closed. Members, I will now open it up for some discussion and questions, but I remind you that this bill is going to be laid over. I'll start with Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chair Kreischer, for bringing this bill. I know we always say that, but I mean that genuinely this time. I think
really?
I read the reports and similarly was really concerned. I think agreement on what the problem is, right? We know that students need support. We know students need support outside of the school day. I think we are all concerned about how our taxpayer dollars go. In this case, you know, there was both fraud and that taxpayer dollars are not going to the right place, and individual families were really severely hurt by that, and that's really concerning. I guess one general question is, and this might be for nonpartisan, do we know how many families access the program like in a given year, and then how much, what that amounted to in terms of how much credit was used?
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. Nonpartisan staff.
Chair Bateberg and Representative Sensenmura, Sean Williams from House Research. So the data that I have is from since 2021 from the Department of Revenue. They indicated that about 287 credits had been assigned. So that's the number of returns that have been filed. I don't have any data on the amount that represents, though.
Okay.
Anything further, Representative Sensenmura?
Yeah, so I would say that feels kind of low to me, right? I mean, that I'm guessing there are more families across the state that could access that than 287. I think that shows that there are some barriers. And then, you know, just doing some quick math, if each of those families got $1,500, you know, that's about $450,000. So not that much. You know, I guess what I'm wondering very broadly is, like, and there's some philosophical differences, right? You know, I would say, I think, you know, if this is a public good, we should be investing in this as a state. We should be building out programming rather than doing the tax credit, right? And so what I think of is, like, are we already doing this someplace within K-12, right? And so I think about, you know, we had the after-school program grants. That was one-time funding. It's not in the base, so I think we're going to have a conversation about whether or not we're going to continue those. And we put $30 million into that, right, which I think was a good amount that will – impact, you know, families across our state and take out the middleman, right, where, you know, families are not having to get a loan, they're not having to figure out later on if this program was certified by MDE. You know, I think I have some general questions about, like, what does a certification look like with MDE? What is the time that it takes for them to do that? Because, again, if we are, as a state, figuring out where should we give grant funding to, right, it seems like on the front end, that's where we should be putting the effort rather than the certification on the back end. So I guess a question for you, Chair Kreischer, I think I have two of them, is, like, is the tax credit the way to go for this? Or, you know, as chair of the K-12 Finance Committee, like, could we just be investing in tutoring programs that work across our state? And then I have a second question, but maybe we'll start with that one.
Chair Carisha.
Thank you, and thank you for the question and the comments, Representative Spencer Mira. I think the tax credit is the way to go because essentially the parents are granting the money before it even works through the government. And essentially that's what we're allowing them to do is at the front end of the step, decide where those go. So that's why I chose the tax credit.
Representative Spencer Mira.
So then I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, you know, and I understand like getting parents some rights and like how they want to invest the money. I think where I'm struggling is if we are still having, are we still having to have MDE certify in the end? It feels like we're still, you know, it feels like there's a tension, I guess, between what the family wants, right? Parents' rights, being able to choose the right tutoring for your child, and still needing some government entity to certify if that was worthwhile, if that meets the standards that we have. And, you know, I know that we're all really concerned about fraud, and so how do we figure out that tension, I guess, between parents' rights, not wanting our tax dollars to go to waste, but then still having to involve MDE as an entity that's telling us whether or not these are good tutoring services?
Chair Carisha.
And thank you for that. Frankly, I don't have the right answer. I mean, I think that's a very good question. I have to go back. As I said, this is a conversation starter. I mean, ultimately, and as the testifier, Mr. Shavers, stated, we want the dollars to go to quality tutoring services, and we hope the parents are going to make some of those right decisions. Setting the standards up and the certification through MDE might be a necessary process to get that. I don't know the right answer for that, but I will look into that if that's okay. And thank you very much. Love to have you help me with the bill. Would be great.
Can I have one more? So,
Representative Sensenmura.
I think one of the things that was most alarming about these articles, right, is that the families are having to then pay back. And right. So, you know, I like the approach of the advanced credit. I'm wondering, could there be some kind of, and I talked a little bit to people on our side of the aisle who know more about taxes, where they're talking about, like, some of our advanced credits have, like, a safe harbor element where people don't have to pay it back. Could we put something like that so we're not in the same situation where people are getting the advanced credit, and then they're still having to end up paying the government back for the services?
Chair Carisha.
And thank you for that. And I've been thinking about that as well. And one of the reasons I like the advanced credit because it reduces the liability to 50%. I mean, there's always going to be a scenario where something's going to go somewhere the wrong place it shouldn't. And hopefully, you know, buyer beware, we have all of that. I don't know the right answer to that, and I don't want to set it up too complicated, but we should look at that. But ultimately, you know, sometimes there can be a loss, and that's why the 50% cuts that loss to half and minimizes that if there's an unfortunate situation. But your questions are right on and things to be considered. I, as I tell my kids, I wish I could take away all the bad things that happen in the world, but sometimes we can't. My kids don't listen to me either.
Representative Bonner.
I'm going to pass for the moment.
Right. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I guess I am just picking up from Chair Crenshaw's comments about, you know, legislating away bad things, right, as we should, because that is our goal, and that is also really important for us as legislators in education finance, right? We want to make sure that students across the state, you know, get everything they need to become who they want to be and thrive later. And so I think for me, I'm interested in this idea about advanced payments. So I'm glad the bill is being laid over and possibly worked on. And I have, I guess, two questions. I just want to tease out a bit, I think, of what Representative Sensenmura was talking about with this kind of, I know you're getting rid of the assignment process, but like also how do we know that you know, we're using taxpayer dollars in a good way, and also want to offer that in Ohio, you know, the state came up with a marketplace with a list of providers that, you know, parents could still choose, but they would know for sure that, you know, using these providers would mean that they would get the tax credit back. You know, understanding you're having this like 50% threshold, but also as you commented, you know, these low-income families often like don't have cash up front, right? And so we just want to minimize for that. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that.
Chair Carisha.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Lee. All good questions, and I appreciate that. I mean, ultimately, I'm trying to get to the front end of this process, reduce the liability. The parents are going to have to choose, and they're going to have to work with the best reputable as they can. I don't know that we can entirely get in the middle of that process. We're already seeing that this has swung too far to one side, and we need to reel it back a little bit, which is why the 50% liability helps a lot and removes some of the risk. I probably don't have the full answers to what you're doing because I don't know that we're going to be able to control all the players. But if we can put this in the hands and the front end of the parents, and we can try to get them and them directing their services to the right spot, and hope, as Mr. Shaver said, I mean, ultimately we need good providers. We need them to also be good actors in this, and we can't create that. I guess I'll leave it there. I'm really discerning and thinking through what you're asking for, and I would try to see if we can button some of that up as this bill would be further worked on.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, and then second question, just shifting gears a little bit, because we're talking about advance payments and giving cash to families. You know, it seems like the families that you're trying to target here are low-income folks who oftentimes have income requirements for programs like WIC or SNAP. And so just curious also if you've contemplated whether these advance payments would be counted as income when you're considering those programs and eligibility.
Chair Carisha.
And I'm not on the tax committee. I'm not the tax chair. The intention it would not be. I mean, it's ultimately a tax credit. So hopefully we're not double doing that. But if I can go to nonpartisan staff, because I'm drowning here.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Bakeberg and Representative Lee, when the legislature established the child credit advance payments, there was some concerns that those might be considered income. Because that they are sort of means-tested payments, they generally qualify for income tax purposes for the general welfare exclusion, meaning they're not subject to income taxes. However, I think that there has been a determination by the federal government that the advance payments of the child credit would be considered income for the purposes of SNAP. However, one difference between those child credit advance payments and the advance credit payments contemplated by this bill is that those are periodic regular, so that they occur in three installments under the child credit, which my understanding is that has some sort of bearing on the determination about whether or not they're income for the purposes of SNAP. So I can't speak sort of directly with certainty about that with regards to SNAP, but I think that there may be reasons that these are not income for the purposes of SNAP, whereas the child credit advance payments may have been considered income for the purposes of SNAP.
Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Williams. Just also another idea to consider as you continue to work on this bill in this committee. And as you referenced, I mean, eventually, I mean, when you've put together your final plan, will this go to taxes?
Chair Carisha.
Thank you, Chair Bakeberg. I'm sure it will be. I'm sure that, you know, we'll talk to the tax chair and see where it goes. I don't have the exact path on where that could go, but if it's going to have the T in it, it's probably going to go through that committee.
And again, this is being laid over. So I'll go to Chair Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Carisha, for bringing this forward. This is an issue that we saw in the last few years that needs to be taken care of, and I know a lot of folks have been working on it, and you and I chatted before that maybe you want to reach out to Representative Norris because he's been working on this as well. And I believe in the Department of Revenue, in the governor's budget proposal in the Department of Revenue, I can't remember if it's in his policy or budget proposal, they do change the assignment, the pre-assignment too. So I think you're on the right track. And I, Representative Lee, thank you so much for bringing up the income base. Every time we do a tax bill, we really look close at that to make sure that we're not kicking folks out of programs inadvertently as well. So taxes are like a big Jenga puzzle and they're complicated. So thank you, Chair Carisha, and thank you for laying it over so we can keep the discussion going.
Thank you, members. Chair Carisha, recognize you to briefly close your bill.
Thank you very much. And so, members, first of all, I should admit that I broke rule number 43 in my handbook of being a good legislator, and that is never try to answer a question when a more knowledgeable person is in the room. So thank you to the nonpartisan staff. And with that, members, what I would just say is I think this has merit, and I think we recognize the problem, and I would invite others to sign on to the bill or help me pass this. I think this is one of those things that could be added on that, if done right, would make a substantial impact. So with that, I would renew my motion, Chair Bakeberg.
Chair lays over House File 779 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. Thank you, members. Chair Carisha, any closing comments that you wanted to say?
Looking forward to Thursday. We have House File 29 on the docket with the vehicle bills, and just look forward to that, and should be a good discussion on Thursday.
All right. Let's see. Yep. I'm going through my list here of things. Members, that concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be Thursday, February 27th, 2025. Thank you all, and the committee stands adjourned.